All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast, the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight, we're going to go back into the jungle and talk about another Vietnam War movie. This one is going to be Full Metal Jacket. This is episode 194 of the show. And before we get into the last narrative portion of the show where we introduce our guests, let's check in with Robert and see how things are going with the mask mandates here in the good old US today, where we're still celebrating our freedoms on a daily basis.
You're doing what now? Are you? Do you know where you are? What's happening? No, Daniel. So bad, sad news. We have caved to the pressure from the state in the mob, and when it is tolerable, I'd say a small minority of the people working at the establishment wear these face shield things. So it's a small concession, I guess. I don't think it's winning any points, but we're doing it, doing our part to protect us all, you know, because your health is evidently my responsibility.
Well, I do appreciate you being so willing to wear face shields. I did hear that neck gaiters are no longer considered safe. And John McAfee just got arrested in Norway for wearing a G-string or a thong, I think it was. I forget. One of the two. But it was some lacy number that qualifies as a face covering because of where he had it. But I don't think it was deemed effective enough to prevent any transmission. Though I've also heard that about many other more typical masks.
So we got like cops on the scene, like making these doctoral scientific claims and judgments as they arrest somebody for their face covering not being quite up to snuff based on their own interpretation of science.
Yeah, apparently that's how it works these days. You got to have these scientific on the spot decisions, you know, made by these highly trained individuals. And so, you know, that's how society ought to run, Robert. And it's got to be coercively tax funded, of course.
I can't possibly imagine a better system. Sounds fantastic.
Yeah. You and me both, brother. Well, let's get into the last night's first of the show, introduce our guests, and we'll start talking about this Stanley Kubrick movie right after these messages. What is this Mickey Mouse shit? Tonight, we're going to be getting with the program recording on the duality of man as we talk about Full Metal Jacket with our buddy John Reed of John Reed Creative. This is episode 137 of the show. You can find the show notes somewhere at lastnighters.com/137. I'm Daniel Elwood. My co-host is Private Robert Johnson. And we are the Last Nighters. You can find us on the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. And like I was mentioning, we're doing Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket, and our guest is John Reed, who has been with us most recently for Apocalypse Now. Prior to that, another Matthew Modine movie, and the band played on. He was also on for Reds and The Aviator. So welcome back to the show, John. We appreciate you joining us, being willing to come back through this process. And why don't you remind people what you do, and we'll get into the show.
It is my pleasure to be here. I am a corporate communications professional, and I do have my website, John Reed Creative, for anybody who wants help with copywriting or video production for their particular business. And I'm also a somewhat of a movie buff. I have an educational background. I went to college for film schools, basically, so I am a film buff. So it's in this particular one, I am particularly excited to talk about, because it's I was telling Dan before the broadcast that this is a movie I pretty much know inside and out. I've seen it so many times. I know all the lines. I know all the ins and outs of the movie. So it's really good to be here for this one.
All right. So you do have a major malfunction. Not only are you with us again, but you, you know, a lot about movies. And so you're going to put our movie critiquing to shame, but that's one of the reasons we have you. So we appreciate you coming back. And how we start off is with the old Google description. So I will get to that now. This came out in 1987. And there was a delay in the filming because Emery broke his ribs in a car accident. So this would have come out back in 86 alongside, I think it was Platoon, but it got delayed a little bit. But rated R, war drama movie, 1 hour and 56 minutes, 8.3 IMDb, 91% Rotten Tomatoes, 76% Metacritic, and 92% of Google users like it. The description reads, Stanley Kubrick's take on the Vietnam War follows a smart aleck Private Davis, played by Matthew Modine, quickly christened Joker by his foul-mouthed drill sergeant, played by R. Lee Ernie, and pudgy Private Lawrence Vincent D'Onofrio, nicknamed Gomer Pyle, as they endure the rigors of basic training. Though Pyle takes a frightening detour, Joker graduates to the Marine Corps and is sent to Vietnam as a journalist, covering and eventually participating in the bloody battle of Hue. Not sure if I said that right, but this came out June 26, 1987. Stanley Kubrick, it was his second to last film. Eyes Wide Shut with his final film that came out almost 12 years later. Box office of $120 million, won a couple of awards, and I think it had an indelible impact on the culture. What's your take on this description there, Robert, and anything with your opening?
Well, I don't have much to say about the Google description. It seemed a pretty rote description of what happens in the film. How I want to start off talking about this movie, though, is by comparing it to another war film, a movie we've done not too long ago, although it's probably been like a year and a half ago now. I swear, things happen so fast. But the movie stars Andrew Garfield. It's done by Mel Gibson. It's called Hacksaw Ridge. This movie, Full Metal Jacket, you have this protagonist, and I use that term very loosely in this film, Joker, where things just kind of happen to him. There's no point in the film where he makes a decision that affects the plot. It's really kind of striking. Even in most like passive protagonists, they still do something that affects something. And I understand they're in the military and they're taking orders. And that's kind of shows the hopelessness of being in a war situation where you really can't show your own character. You can't make decisions that affect your own future. You're kind of at the mercy of people giving you orders. But if you compare this film to Hacksaw Ridge has a very definitive beginning, middle, and end to the film. In the beginning, you meet this character who is a devout Christian, and he won't pick up a rifle. And that's like big no-no in the military, of course, because you have to. You have to be able to shoot and you have to be able to fight. It's the whole point. But he's very principled to stand. And people don't want to fight with him because they see him as a coward and they see it as like a weakness. Like, I'm going to be protecting you with my rifle, but you're not going to protect me with your rifle, that kind of thing. So he gets thrown in the brig and ultimately he gets out and they let him serve as like a medical guy in this big battle at the end. And they find out that, oh, he's not a coward at all. He's actually super brave because he ends up going above and beyond and rescuing all these people from this big battlefield. And it's not a traditional arc of a character where the guy learns something and he changes in the end. It's actually more his comrades changing as they view him and see his value. So it's the world changing around him. But it still has the beginning, middle, and an end. And in this film, you start off in boot camp and you find out that boot camp sucks. Okay. That's the entire beginning. The first 45 minutes or something, the first third of the film. Then they go to Da Nang, where he's like a reporter, and you get a variety of scenes. At one point, one guy gets his camera stolen for no reason. It has nothing of any value to the plot. There's scenes where he's talking to his CO, where they're talking about what to cover. Nothing ever comes of it, except the CO ends up sending him on a mission at the end, but he still has no effect on the plot of his decision to go or not. Even the guy that goes with him actually has more of an effect on the plot. He goes, oh, let me go too. So, and then at the very end, he's fighting in this battle, and he doesn't even, I mean, I guess at the end, he shoots the sniper who was going to die anyway. So I think the Kubrick's filmmaking is quite impressive. He really sets the tone. There's all kinds of great visuals, and you really get the hopelessness of it all. But I'm sitting there watching it going, I'm not connecting with this guy. I have no feeling towards Joker other than that he's kind of this sardonic counter character to all the military rah, rah, rah. But he never does anything that makes me go, oh, I like this guy. He's not making any choices, and he's not doing anything brave or bold, or I don't know. I felt very much like, why does this movie exist? So hopefully, you know, we've got a great guest that knows this movie inside and out. And I'm sure Daniel liked it more than I did. And I'm not saying this is a bad movie. I'm not saying this is a bad movie at all. I'm just saying that I didn't connect with anything that was really going on other than to witness the horror of it all, of course. But I wasn't really on board for Joker and his story because he never did anything. That's what I got.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your open here, Robert. And it is going to, I'm going to push back a bit throughout this entire episode, I think. But I want to ask you one question. How many times have you seen this movie?
I think 3 or 4 times.
Okay. That surprises me because your analysis so far in your opening seems like one from somebody who has maybe seen it for the first time. And I don't mean that in a shitty way.
Bring it, sir.
But what I mean is I can see in watching it for the first time, you're kind of trying to get the idea of what's going on, what's the plot, what are the characters' motivations, what's trying to be conveyed in this. And that seems a bit almost surface kind of stuff, what you're looking for and kind of talking about here, where I'm thinking more along the lines of knowing Kubrick as a director and how there's a lot of symbolism in what he does, or at least a lot of perceived symbolism. I'm trying to look for more of like deeper meanings in what is presented on the screen and trying to analyze it and contemplate on it. I've seen this movie probably a dozen times now. And the first time I saw it, I just really enjoyed the drill sergeant character and his just insults and his ability to just rattle them off. And I think I was probably in high school when I saw it. And so like if someone could do really good swears, that was like very impressive to me.
That's a good reason to like a movie, but okay. I mean, I'll buy it. Whatever you like, I don't care.
Yeah, but I think that there is a lot more to this movie, and I'm trying to work some theories in my head that I was going to kind of throw out at you guys tonight, especially at John, because John, I know that you're a fan of the movie. You've seen it a bunch of times. And so I wanted to see if any of the kind of ideas I have might strike a chord with you, or if you can just brush them aside and say, no, it definitely wasn't that. But anyway, John, do you have a take on the opening here and any of Robert's comments so far?
Yeah. So when I first saw this movie, it was probably I had seen Platoon, and I thought that was a really great Vietnam War movie. And then I think the first time I saw Full Metal Jacket was when it came on HBO. I was in high school. And I just thought, like, wow, this is so much better than Platoon. And I just because it was grittier, it was more raw. The emotions were a lot more real to me. And Kubrick really conveyed all the kind of the horrors of war. One thing I will say about Robert's interpretation of Joker's role in this movie initially. And it took me like a little while to kind of work this out of my head because I just liked the movie so much. I like didn't really think there needed to be too much interpretation of it. But I think when you think of what Joker's role in the war was, he was a journalist. So he's pretty much keeping an account of what's going on in the Vietnam War. And I think it's a different role than what we think of journalists today, like with CNN and Don Lemon and Aaron Burnett and Chris Cuomo and those kind of things. I think that Joker really tried to be a real journalist. And obviously, I think he, because of the peace symbol, because of the born to kill, and his speech about the duality of man, I think he was a hippie guy who was basically for peace and against the war, who was just caught up in the draft and had to go or risk imprisonment. So I think he was just going to be like, okay, well, I want to be a journalist anyway, so that's the role I'm going to play. I'm going to volunteer for the Marines, and I can do pretty much what I want to do. So I think his story is kind of just one account of what was going on in Vietnam. I mean, fictional as it might be, I think there was a lot of realistic elements to it, like the basic training, the Tet Offensive, that sort of thing. And I think I think you're just kind of getting into his tale or his account of what happened to him. So I think, like, you know, you think he doesn't have that big of a role, or he doesn't make the big decisions, but I don't think as a journalist he has to make those big decisions as far as descending upon an enemy or strategic battle tactics or something like that. I think he just has to go along for the fight. And I think he just has to account. And obviously he gets in the shit when he needs to, because he's one of the ones who goes after the sniper and participates in a lot of the fighting. So I think he's not just a journalist, but I think that's his main role. And especially in this movie, I think that's why he's not the primary protagonist as you would traditionally think he is.
Wow. Okay. See, even that I think isn't like as super deep as I was thinking. So Robert, do you want to respond and then I can go indeed. Into my weird thing.
Okay. I don't understand when you say that he's a journalist and he can do what he wants, and then he's against the war and that sort of thing. He works for Stars and Stripes, a primary propaganda rag for the military to boost morale. That's all Stars and Stripes does. It's all they do. That's all they've ever done. So I don't know how you could say that he's like this journalist, an actual real journalist. I think
that's more of his goal than, because if the editorial meeting that he has with his, I guess his editor, you would call him, he pushes back a lot. The editor gives him like the propaganda kind of things, like the good news stories, the feel good stories that the soldiers might want to hear. But, you know, how he says, like, well, how many kills do you want? And he's like, well, soldiers like reading about dead general or dead officers. And he's like, okay, well, how about a general? And so he is kind of like anti-establishment in that way, and that he really wants to tell the truth, but ultimately he realizes he's not the ultimate decision maker. Although I think his heart is real, true journalism. I think he's, because of his position and because of where he has to be in this particular, again, either this or he risks being in prison, that he's got to do what he's got to do and make the best of a good situation. It's kind of like, I guess if you want to say, if you want to change things from the inside, where somebody who is anti-government might go into Congress to cut, like Ron Paul or something, might want to change things from the inside. I think he's doing his best that he can for his journalistic integrity, even though obviously there are certain institutionalized propaganda standards in place, I mean, that he can't even do what he really wants to do. But I mean, that's just the nature of the military and the government.
I would agree with that. Although if his desire is to be a real journalist, I question why he joined the Marines in the first place. Hmm. I mean, he starts off saying, you know, I joined because I want to kill people. And obviously he's lying to the drill sergeant, but,
I think the drill sergeant kind of gets that out of him. If he was to say anything, well, why did you join the Marines? And he says to kill, well, what's he going to say? I mean, that's the job of the Marine. And, you know, right. If he's going to say like, well, I really came here just to kind of like write articles about the war and get my perspective, give my perspective on what's going on here. Like, no, you have to, like he says in the basic training narrative, the voiceover, he says, you know, the Marines don't want soldiers. They want robots. And he's got to give the kind of robot answer to the question of like, well, why did you join the Marines? To kill, sir.
So I don't necessarily disagree with any of that. I'm just, from what my experience of watching movies, if this is going to be Joker's story, and he's a journalist. He can be, there's been many movies about journalists who go on very brave and they write stories or they uncover whatever horror or whatever. But in this film, nothing he does matters. Nothing he decides to do matters. He doesn't actually choose anything that goes against the grain, and he doesn't fight the system. He just kind of middles with it a little bit and tries to niggle his way in, you know, get his little digs in these little stories that get past his propaganda censors. Other than that, what does he do? He's just kind of around observing. So it's more a story of the war and his view of it than a story of him. Like, it's not necessarily Joker's story. It's just the story of Vietnam as witnessed by Joker. And for me, it turns it into documentary filmmaker territory and less of a feature film narrative structure.
But is that the point ultimately in the end? Because when you join the military service and you go to war, do you really have a story in the sense that the government looks upon you as just a robot or an expendable pawn? Are you supposed to have a story, or are you supposed to be just one person who is either going to kill or going to be killed? So, I mean, it is, I guess it's unfulfilling in the sense that, yeah, you don't get to know the real Joker. You don't get to know his life before he entered the Marines, and you don't get to know a lot about his life outside of his military service. But I almost think that's kind of the point. When you're making a movie about war, you have to really, and you're looking at these soldiers as what their role is in a war, then it's kind of like a mindless, soulless, non-personality kind of being who's just meant to shoot at an enemy and fire.
Right, which is why I brought up Hacksaw Ridge and the story of that guy who really kind of bucked that system.
Yeah, it's definitely a contrast.
Yeah. All right, Daniel, let's get into your deep thoughts with Daniel Handy.
All right, Daniel Handy's got the deep thoughts. Now, I find it interesting that you guys viewed him as a journalist as if that was his motivation or his goal going into this. We don't even discover that he is interested in journalism until after basic training, and he gets assigned to the journalist pool or whatever because he wrote for the high school paper. So it's only revealed like halfway through the film. And I agree, there isn't like the traditional, you know, narrative plot line kind of presentation here of this film. But I think that's kind of the point. That's part of what Kubrick was going for. I think that the comment of the duality of man describes the film in its essence. You've got the two parts, the beginning with the basic training, and then you've got the actualization when he's actually out in Vietnam persecuting the war. And part of my theorizing is that if you view this as not necessarily like meant to be taken in a as presented kind of way, like this isn't just a story of somebody going to boot camp and having a harrowing experience, being demoralized and made to be less than human, given, you know, like a different name to strip their identity away from them and like form into a new socialist man. I was viewing Pyle and Joker as two pieces of the same character. And by the end of this maturation process with Ermy as the father figure, berating them and doing the psychological torture, we see the doe-eyed, doughy innocence fall away as it can't hack it with this military training or the needs of becoming this killer, this new socialist man that is going to go and kill people at the behest of generals and people giving him orders. So I saw this as a stripping of individuality and a killing of the immature or childlike part of Joker. And that the only thing that allowed him to survive this was to be that sort of sardonic, wry, witty guy who kind of pushed back in maintaining some of his individuality, whereas everyone else all became assimilated in through this initiation process.
Okay, so you're saying that everybody else besides Joker was transformed into this Marine killing machine? And yeah, the Joker was just able to resist it through his.
Well, he still lost. Resist. He still lost a part of himself. He lost that doe-eyed innocence, that pile portion of himself. And as far as like his role in the boot camp part, in the more literal sense, he was there helping Gomer Pyle try to improve, try to get through the camp without having the rest of the team punished.
Trying to save his own innocence. Is that what you're saying?
Right. But then that was the final breaking point for Pyle, was when Joker beat him with the soap. Not when everyone else did. Like, Ermy was breaking him down, the drill sergeant, psychologically, you know, berating him, giving him, treating him like a baby, calling him, you know, a fat, grotesque motherfucker, you know, whatever else he called him. And that was like tearing him down. But then when the rest of the recruits beat him with the soap, like that very last strand of humanity that was still holding him was his, not even friendship, but his relationship with Joker. And then when Joker, who was hesitating, finally hit him with the soap as well, that was the last straw. And that's when he finally snapped. And that's when that portion of this character was now dead.
So you don't see him as innocent doe-eyed after the death of Pyle.
No, but then he still has to go through this Vietnam process, because his evolution is not complete until he has achieved that kill at the very end, when he puts the sniper out of her misery. Because he hesitates in doing that. And Animal Mother's like, no, just let her suffer. Like, she killed a couple of our guys, and now she's injured, and there's nothing we can do about it. You can put her out of her misery, or we can let her suffer. And he was more than willing to let her suffer. Like, they just wanted revenge at that point. And he was essentially doing a mercy killing. And even that was difficult for Joker to do. But once he did it, you can see at the end, he develops that 1,000-yard stare.
Okay.
So, John, any of these pieces kind of fit in anything here?
Well, I kind of view Joker as like this, not the standard soldier, like the Marine, but he does what he has to do. I think your point is salient as far as the doe-eyed kind of personality that Pyle had. Now, personally, like, this is what I didn't understand about Pyle. Why he apparently, like, way I understood it, if you volunteered for the military service, you could pick whatever branch you wanted to go into. So why Pyle would pick the Marines is beyond me. I mean, like, he could have just been in the army and just been a regular infantry. They would have been glad to have him, but the Marines, they want the best of the best. And the whole drill sergeant shtick is to break you down if they can, because if they break you down to the point where you just can't hack it anymore, then they don't want you in the Marines. They'll put you somewhere else. They'll put you in the army or whatever. So what the gunnery sergeant did was something you have to do to make sure that, like, you weren't sending Marines into battle that couldn't hack it. And so I think that Joker, by contrast, was just something like, again, like, even though he was probably in his real life against the war, in his civilian life against the war, he was just somebody like, okay, well, I'm here. I got to do what I got to do to get through this. And when he had to hit Pyle with the soap, and I don't really get that Pyle knew that Joker was hitting him. I mean, obviously he knew everybody was hitting him, so eventually he understood that Joker had hit him too. But I think that Joker did whatever he had to do to move forward, and whether that was doing what he had to do in basic training, hitting Pyle with the soap in order to get him to behave in the way he needed to behave so that he could, the rest of the platoon didn't have to start doing pointless exercises because every time Pyle fucked up. And then later on, when he was in battle, when he had to, you know, be a journalist, he was a journalist, but when he had to fight, he could fight. So I think he was more of a basic kind of character, kind of like the standard military character that you needed to be in order to get through what he had to get through. Pyle, on the other hand, I think had a lot of innocence going into it. I don't think he knew what he was getting into when he first signed up, but he definitely obviously lost a big part of himself when he realized that he either had to be a killer or he had to, I don't know what his alternative was, like to just finally say, hey, you got to get me out of here because I can't hack this. And they probably would have found something for else to do, but he came to that fork in the road where he's like, I have to be a mindless robotic killer, or I have to admit that I can't do what they're asking me to do. So I think obviously he made the choice that he had to make, and to the point where he blew his own drill sergeant away. So he became the ultimate killing machine that the Marines probably wanted, but couldn't control.
Yeah. I found it interesting. And I didn't realize that, all of those guys were enlisted. They weren't drafted. Mm-hmm. I thought that there was a fair amount of drafting going on, and I didn't know if it applied to all branches or just specific branches like the Army or whatever. So I guess it does change the how I would read this a little bit in knowing that they chose to be there versus being drafted into it. But I think that the Gomer Pyle character, he wasn't cut out for it. But then also there wasn't anywhere for him to go. Like if he wanted to back out or get out, then they would have just berated him even more, wouldn't they? So like right. Yeah. So it wasn't like he was going to be able to, change his mind or whatever, especially after they broke him down the way that they did. And I do think that he did know it was Joker because while Cowboy was holding him down, he was able to look to the side, and I think he could see that it was Joker who was the last one to hit him and that there was the hesitation. So I think that was that moment that was the straw that broke that camel's back.
And Cowboy had to say, come on, do it. So I think Pyle probably had an inkling that Joker would be the one person in the whole platoon that would have hesitation in hitting him with the soap.
Right. And it was also interesting that after that happened, Pyle actually became fairly competent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the the activities.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I don't know. That's kind of interesting that he would snap like that and then actually now be better at what they wanted him to be doing in the first place.
Well, again, I think like he had to make that decision. Was he gonna focus? I mean, like when Joker was showing him how to do things, like take apart the gun or lace his boots correctly or make his bed correctly, you could see like Pyle was just looking at him like a little child. And, you know, he was trying, he was doing his best to get along and do the best job he could. But as long as he had that attitude that like, he was just this sweet little country guy who was just in the Marines, that wasn't going to do it for him. So after it became clear that his platoon wasn't going to tolerate that sort of cavalier attitude toward what they were all doing, I think he just had to make something snapped in him where he had to make the choice to focus on actually being a killing machine or whatever the other alternative is, either jail or demotion or whatever, wherever they were going to send him.
Yeah. I kept wanting.
Oh, go ahead, Robert.
Well, I kept wanting him to quit.
Yeah. So did I.
I didn't understand why he just kept going when he was clearly not cut out for this.
Right.
It was clearly affecting his mental status. I mean, he was having a really, really hard time with it, and everybody hated him, and that really affected him. Now, I guess I've watched the film a little bit differently than you guys. I didn't really see the soap incident as transformative as you did. Maybe I need to watch it again. Maybe that is the flipping point. But, and maybe it really is the point where he changes his mindset, because then he does start to shoot well and that sort of thing. But maybe that was the first time they showed him shooting at all. So I don't know. But I saw the main flipping point, and maybe it's because I wasn't watching the carefully as you guys, but I saw it at when they were on the bleachers and he gets announced that he's going to be a rifleman. And then he gets that 1,000-yard stare. And then he's like really processing, what does that mean? Am I going to be a killer now? And can I handle that? And then we get the scene in the latrine. So I don't know. am I just missing something, or is that the what really does it for him?
Well, remember when they're in the bleachers and the drill sergeant is talking about how important shooting is to a Marine. He brings up Lee Harvey Oswald and of course we all know that Lee Harvey Oswald didn't act alone, but he uses that as an example. He said, Lee Harvey Oswald was a Marine. He learned to shoot in the Marines and he got off 3 shots within 8 seconds, including a headshot. And I think, you know, when they show Pyle, I think that's sort of like sinking in. It's like, oh shit, you know, like I could be a killer. Like I could do something really great. I mean, I don't know what his aspirations were after that, but I mean, like, I think he understood that he too could be a killer. If Lee Harvey Oswald could be a killer, then he could be a killer too. That's how I kind of read that scene.
Yeah. I read that differently. I read it as he's just there in his own little world in his head and just staring off blankly in this kind of demented way. So he's just kind of going through the rote like training, but he's not like thinking about what's being said really.
I got it differently. I think he is absorbing what the drill instructor is telling him. I think he's kind of soaking in the notion that, yeah, as a Marine, you have the power to kill and you could do really life-altering actions. You could really make life-altering actions with your rifle if you choose to. And I think that's part of the process of him choosing to do that.
Yeah, I think I've read that as being the scene where shit became real for him and that he wasn't quite mentally capable of handling it. That's what I read.
So that involves some premeditation in him shooting the drill sergeant. Do you think that was a premeditated situation, or was he going to the bathroom to kill himself and then Joker comes upon him and as he's discovered, he starts making a bunch of racket and then Emery comes in and he ends up shooting him? Not in a planned way, but in a, because he's there and he's confronting him, he shoots him and then shoots himself.
Yeah, that's the way I read that.
Yeah, I think if he was going to be a killer, then the ultimate kill would be the person who he was supposed to respect the most, or the person who gave him the hardest time. Now, I think it was premeditated in the sense that he was in that bathroom. He knew somebody was on watch and was going to find him. And when he started yelling and doing his little drill, I think he knew that eventually that the drill sergeant was going to get in there and there was going to be some kind of confrontation. And I do think he had every intention of firing that weapon on the drill instructor. So I do think it was premeditated. I think it was his ultimate display of how much of a killer he could become.
Interesting. Now, there was that moment where he did point the rifle then at Joker. Mm-hmm. And Joker was like, come on, man, go easy. Do you think that was a decision point that he was going to do it? And then he recollected or he recalled that Joker was actually the guy who was like trying to help him.
That was the last of his humanity that he held on to. And I think if Joker had been a dick to him, if he hadn't, handled him most of the time with compassion and understanding, I think Joker would have been lying on the floor with the drill instructor. But I think the last bit of humanity that Pyle had in him was expended on Joker for the way he treated him up until then.
So do you think if it had been anyone else on watch?
Yeah.
They would have gone away.
They probably would have been dead.
Okay. Interesting. I think that's one of the great things about movies in general, but especially like a Kubrick film, where different people can read different things into it. And I think some of it's intentional with his artistic craft and his technical brilliance. But I also think that part of it is so open to interpretation because he doesn't like try to ram a particular narrative down your throat, you know? And there's a lot of like ambiance and nuance and audio cues and musical cues that go along with the final presentation in the film. And you see this in many of his films, Clockwork Orange, 2001, The Shining, which Robert found very boring. But Robert, I
agree.
If you were to watch Full Metal Jacket again, I think you would see some of the stuff that we're talking about.
I've seen the film many times, Daniel. I don't know. You're not really selling me on these super deep arguments. Now let's move on to Joker being in Da Nang. And right, I need to ask you a question.
Well, before you get into that, can we all agree that if Kubrick can turn England into war-ravaged Vietnam, then he sure as hell could have pulled off the moon landing?
Oh, yeah. No, he absolutely pulled off the moon landing. What are you talking about? Of course he did.
All right, go ahead, Robert.
So is this movie made better by Two Live Crew or worse by Two Live Crew? Because I clearly think it's better, but it does take you a bit out of the movie when you're watching that scene, and all you can think of is, what is it, Sex Shop, I think is the name of the song?
I don't think that's...
No, it's Fuck Shop. It's Fuck Shop.
That's the
TV. It's the PG-13 version of the song?
Yeah, yeah. This is one of the songs that Tipper Gore railed against back when the conservatives were trying to control morality, and now it's, of course, the left trying to control morality. Or
Al Gore's wife.
Yeah, Al Gore's wife. I heard Two Live Crew well before I saw this movie for the first time. And so, yeah, that was like, whoa, that's from that song.
Yeah. Does it distract you from watching the film? All it did was remind me of Two Live Crew, that whole scene. Well, and I'm like,
for about 2 minutes thereafter,
like so many lines from that scene.
Yeah. For about 2 minutes thereafter that scene, I don't know what happened in the movie because I'm playing the whole song in my head.
Yeah. Okay. So it's made better by Two Live Crew. Okay. They enhanced the experience. I like it.
Yeah, it's an embellishment. What's your take, John? Did you hear Two Live Crew before you saw the movie, or did you see the movie and then hear Two Live Crew?
No, I saw the movie first and then heard Two Live Crew. So I'm still not a huge fan of rap, but I was not a big fan of rap back in my early college days. And I was like, I thought like, well, are they so devoid of talent that they even have to take lines from movies and make it into a song? Like, is that how they become popular, or that how they make a hit song, is that they take other people's content and put it out in a different form? It kind of pissed me off because I like Full Metal Jacket so much, but I'm over it now. I think it's just hilarious.
Hey man, you're ripping on one of our best guests.
Yeah, our buddy Mike C does Mechanical Dream Revolution, where he takes clips from movies and then various songs and pieces it together in these long form narratives.
I'm not saying it doesn't have its place. Like, I just like, it's kind of like the whole Broadway thing back when you could actually go to New York and see a show, like Mamma Mia or Moving Out. The you take hit songs and you make them into a musical. Like, I just feel I could do that. You know, it doesn't seem like it's, I like originality more than I do like repurposing already made content, you know, already created content,
like a reimagining of it.
Yeah. Exactly.
So back to a little bit of symbolism. Do you think that there's any purpose to the references to Mickey Mouse in this? Because Drill Sergeant says it at the beginning, what kind of Mickey Mouse outfit is this? And then at the end, they sing the Mickey Mouse Club song. And if I tie that into, that's the thing of childhood and they're being broken down from the individuals they are in the boot camp. And then they sort of like reacclimate themselves a little bit or become who they are again, but they still have that like piece of their childhood still left to them. Then they start singing the song. I kind of felt that it sort of bookended the movie in a way, the two references to Mickey Mouse.
Yeah. I think it's sort of a connection to, again, back to the kind of concept of innocence lost in war. I think when any time where the fighting's over and soldiers can recapture that kind of connection to real life and to more innocent time, I think they would probably take advantage of it. You know, I think it's like the movie Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, when they're trying to do a sing-along on the bus and Steve Martin's doing Three Coins in a Fountain and John Candy finally does something that everybody knows, the Flintstones theme song. I think it's like that sort of connection. You can always go back to something from your childhood that you really loved and everybody connects with it. So I think, especially when you were in war and you have a break from the chaos and from the horror, anytime you can whistle a Mickey Mouse song, I think, or sing a Mickey Mouse song, I think that's, you got to take advantage of it just to keep your sanity, so you don't end up like a Gomer Pyle and put a barrel in your throat.
Yeah. I could see that. I would tend to agree that this, you know, the more you're told what to do, the more you find little ways to rebel. And that's just another way to do it. Although I'm not necessarily that the military gives a shit if you, what song you're singing, but it's not necessarily some rah, rah, we're going to go kill. Like all the boot camp songs, those boot camp chant songs were some pretty rough stuff, man. Those guys were really dehumanizing the enemy and dehumanizing themselves.
Eskimo genitalia?
I don't remember the exact lines in the boot camp songs.
That was one of them, yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to repeat it because this is a family show, right?
Oh, yeah.
This is 100% pure Alabama Black family show. But, yeah, and those were all songs led by the drill sergeant. So it was a call and response thing, or he would, like, say the line and then they would repeat it. So it wasn't necessarily, like, songs that they knew. They were just repeating what he was telling them.
And the dehumanizing part of it, I think, goes back to, again, turning these people into killing robots who have as minimal emotion as possible and can just be focused on their animal instincts and their killer instincts.
Right. And so many of the soldiers that we see in Vietnam are totally fucked up. Mm-hmm. Like the guy who has, you know, his buddy is the dead Vietnamese soldier. Animal mother is like totally fucked up and just wants to kill people. The guy that they meet on the helicopter, who's like, isn't it, have you killed women and children? And he says, yeah. And like, how do you do that? You know, like, and Joker of course means like, how do you bring yourself to be capable of doing that? And he says, well, you just lead them a little less.
Yeah.
It's kind of this really dark humor joke because they don't run as fast. And then he says, war is hell. But it seems like almost every character in this, especially in the second half of the film, is really screwed up. Maybe except for Cowboy. But Cowboy's sort of ineffectual, you know? Like, when he finally assumes command after the first two kind of squad leaders or whatever end up getting killed, and one of them dies following the White Rabbit. Like, that was a little bit of symbolism. He gives orders and nobody respects him.
Yeah, and I think, I think actually one exception to the people who kind of lose their personality, I think I would say the exception would be 8-Ball, the guy who was kind of in charge of navigating the platoon through the area, and they got him he's the one who got him lost, and Cowboy sends him into that the buildings to find a path to cut across and to be where they're supposed to be, and that's where he gets snipered. I think 8-Ball was kind of like the most easygoing of the bunch. Mm-hmm. And I think when you're in battle, that certainly doesn't get you anywhere. I think Rafterman, the guy who was working with Joker on the paper of the Stars and Stripes, and he really wanted to get into the shit. And Joker, he made Joker take him along. And when he had to, he turned it on. He became a killer. He took out that sniper. But otherwise, he hadn't been in battle. He hadn't had to prove his worth in battle. And I think 8-Ball, by contrast, he'd been in battle, but he's maintained his kind of nice guy personality. And ultimately, I think that's probably the thing, narrative wise, that gets you killed in a movie like this.
Now, was Joker trying to protect Rafterman because he was trying to protect his innocence and keep him away from the shit? Or did Joker see something in him that made him not want him to be, I don't know, like, did he see something in him where he would have enjoyed killing? So he saw maybe a little bit of Gomer Pyle in him?
No, I think he just thought of Rafterman as kind of like a goofball, kind of innocent kind of guy. Maybe kind of like now that I'm thinking about it, maybe it's kind of like a Gomer Pyle thing where he didn't want another Gomer Pyle on his hands. He wanted to keep him as fresh and as innocent as possible. So he was going to be the protector to make sure that what happened to Gomer Pyle back in basic training didn't happen to hurt him. Of course, when Rafterman had to turn it on, he saved Joker's life. So it actually worked out for the best.
Right. And it's also interesting that Joker's trained in the basic training that his rifle is his life, and he's useless without his rifle. But then his rifle is what fails him in that extreme moment. And he's about to die as a result. And another thing I found interesting was just the nature of the entrenched defender being able to be in a far better position than those trying to encroach. You know, like, she killed three or four of their guys. They didn't know how many people were up there. It could have been a whole bunch. It could have been, you know, who knows. And how much ammunition did they waste just shooting into the void, you know, in response? And she used what, like, five bullets?
Yeah.
Yeah, but tactically, why was she still there after they got past the courtyard with the smoke grenades? As soon as I see those smoke grenades, I'm out of there if I'm that sniper.
I agree. See that smoke, I'm out.
I think it kind of goes back to Apocalypse Now, what turned Colonel Kurtz into kind of like the warmongering psychopath that he became, is that he understood that the Viet Cong were capable of doing things that the American soldier was not. And I think she was going to stay there until she died, one way or the other. She was going to kill as many American soldiers as she could before she died, but she was there for the long haul. Like, she was either going to kill all of them and then get out, or she was going to kill as many as she could and be killed in the process. But I think she was committed to the cause in a way that American soldiers probably would not have been.
Yeah, absolutely. And that has been absolutely the true in history. Yeah, with the defending Viet Cong, they were very much more committed force than the American military was. What were you going to say, Daniel?
Well, I just found it odd that they, when they went into that building, that they all split up. Because you would think that that would lead them into positions where they might encounter each other, thinking that they're the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's bad tactics.
Absolutely. Yeah, that seems super dangerous, especially when you don't know how many snipers are up there. I mean, there could have been more than one. I guess they sort of knew it wasn't like a full defending force. They knew it was just like one or more maybe people, but not a whole bunch. Like, Cowboy was trying to call in tanks because he didn't know what was up ahead, and Animal Mother just went up there and, you know, because he was pissed off, and he's
kind Rambo, of man,
warrior dude. Yeah. You know, that's another interesting thing that I felt like Joker, he had that attachment to Cowboy. And then when he saw Cowboy die, then he was willing to now follow Animal Mother and go for the revenge, which I think he would have resisted before that moment, before Cowboy got killed. He wouldn't have been into the revenge thing. Like, there was that scene where they go to that mass grave where the dead bodies are covered in lye. And he was, I don't know, it seemed like he was looking at this as just like this travesty, you know, like this was an unnecessary horror of war. And that's, I think, was that where the colonel called him out on having the peace sign and the born to kill? And he's doing the duality of man thing. And I thought that was, Joker still had kind of that bit of humanity to him, where he was, there was a contrast where he could look at things from a moral view, but then when it affected him personally, when his friend died, then he was willing to put that aside. And I think that was part of that journey towards him finally, I don't know, being able to kill the sniper, which, I mean, he, for all he knew, had killed people before, right? When he was doing, when he was battling earlier in firefights and whatnot. Though, I don't know, did they show him actually hit anybody, like, with a confirmed kill?
They showed, there's that one scene where he's defending the Da Nang base, where he's got a machine gun, and he's mowing down all those guys.
Oh, yeah, the Tet. Yeah.
But they don't necessarily say that he was the one actually getting any kills, but it seemed like he did.
Right, there was a good chance.
There was a good chance. I mean, spraying bullets at a whole bunch of Russian guys, so yeah, probably. But it's a little bit different situation, spraying a bunch of guys who are running at you trying to kill you, and this injured lady laying on the ground.
Yeah, it's a lot more of like a intimate experience, like it's one-to-one, very close.
And this is probably like a big conflict for that character, because number one, this person killed his best friend, but two, she's suffering and he wants to, he's like, we just can't leave her here. He has to end her suffering, but he does it in a way that apparently is quite grotesque, and that's probably the revenge for Cowboy element of it coming out. It's again the duality of man. Like, he's compassionate, but then he's vengeful at the same time.
Yeah, and I heard
come
that
on, man, you guys keep mentioning the duality of man. Come on, man.
Yeah, I was reading that the bathroom scene where Gomer shoots himself, that same audio, that gunshot audio, is what was used for the final scene when Joker kills the sniper. And I also noticed some of the soundtrack elements were reminiscent of The Shining, especially when they're going into that building, into that structure. And it's like creepy as hell, you know, like who knows what's around the corner. And there's all these audio cues that are meant to kind of keep you on edge. And I think that was like one of the elements that Kubrick does so well. And of course, there's that, you know, looking from below shot, which he does in all the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like you remember in The Shining when he's in the freezer.
Death is in both buildings, sniper hideout, and it's in the Overlook Hotel.
I missed that part. You said the Overlook?
The specter of death is in both buildings. It's in the Overlook Hotel, and it's in that building where the sniper's hiding out. So maybe the movie, the music is reminiscent of both. Just a theory.
Mm-hmm. All right. So do you guys have any other notes before we start to wind down here?
I do, yeah.
Okay, go for it, Robert.
You've mentioned this scene with the body duality of man. Lie. The duality of man. I think you've mentioned it a few times.
Wait, what?
And what I found more interesting, I mean, this is kind of obvious. I'm going to go Mr. Obvious here. But he talks to the general, and this general is like getting upset about the peace sign and the Born to Kill. But the general, I think, has at one point, he says, all I've ever asked is that people need to obey my orders like the word of God. And inside every gook is an American trying to get out. And it really, I think if you're some sort of like imperialist kind of, I mean, they sold that war saying that we need to go help these people stop communism and that the North Vietnamese were really coming down and trying to destroy the whole country and that kind of thing. And we needed to come in. And then as the war dragged on, like the justifications didn't quite seem to match and they had to keep coming up with new reasons. And then eventually it's like, well, just being there and all the dead Americans and the dead people kind of justifies itself. It's kind of like the same with every war. It's always started on bullshit. And then it's like, it's a perpetual motion machine where the justifications for being there are, well, we can't leave now that we've killed all these people and all these people have died. You can't die for nothing. But this mentality of that these people are good people, they're trying to be good Americans, but we just need to show them how. I mean, I think a like a social justice type mentality would look at that and say that this is like American imperialism and white savior attitude. I think it's just a kind of a disgusting mentality to have. And that this is some, I guess, kind of white supremacy, superiority type actual in effect right there. Saying that these brown people are ignorant savages and that we just need to show them the right way. But then the first thing he says that all I've ever asked is that people obey my orders like the word of God. I understand that in a life and death situation, maybe the guy that has the best idea of how to survive that situation is probably the guy to listen to. But when you need to order people around with the threat of death and that this is somehow a virtuous thing, and that, like, he's a great moral person. All I've ever asked, I'm just asking that you obey me like you would God, is a bit megalomaniacal. And maybe that's the mentality you have to be a general, where you're ordering people into situations where you know thousands of them are going to die. I don't know. I don't think I'll ever be in that position, but I can only imagine the mental gymnastics required to get through that and still be able to sleep at night. So.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. And I think that part of it is if you're the one sort of like strategizing, then you want the people that you're giving orders to do exactly as you ask so that your expected outcome is more likely than if they do kind of not follow the orders. So I can kind of see like the desire to have, well, this is what I've planned out and I want you to do this to a T. And how to convey that very quickly would be to, you know, maniacally say, I want you to obey me like these are orders from God. So I can kind of see that connection as far as if you're the one planning it, and you want the operation to go how you envision it. Now, that's not to say things are going to go that way. It's war, and a thousand different things can go wrong, but I can just see that perspective. Like, you want them to do what you're telling them to do without deviation.
Right. But it also doesn't take into account the fact that you're never going to be in, have the full knowledge of the facts on the ground when you're making these plans, and that situations may change, and then soldiers on the ground would have to adapt to those situations. But like you said, I can understand why a general would want people to do exactly as they say.
And it's probably the mentality that, you know, first started with Woodrow Wilson and the making the world safe for democracy. Like, it's our job to do that. And I think as far as, like, once America really got on its imperialist kind of kick, remember the Vietnam War was the first war we really didn't claim victory in. And so that was, I think, the length of the war, the reason that we stayed there so long was that, like, you know, we're America, we don't lose. And the particular generals, like the one that you're referencing in that particular scene, you know, you've got, like, this platonic kind of vision, the ideal vision of what victory looks like. And if that isn't achieved, then it has to be because somebody else is screwing it up. Somebody under your command is screwing it up. And I think that's the same thing that happened in the Soviet Union or any kind of other socialist kind of or big government kind of nation, is that, you know, you've got this vision for your perfect society. And if it's not going well, it's got to be somebody, you know, lower than you who's fucking it up for you. So you can't have that. So you've got to obey the word of God or suffer the consequences. Otherwise, you know, the utopian vision is never going to be realized as promised.
Yeah, these guys need to watch Superman Red Sun. It doesn't matter if you have Brainiac and Superman trying to pull this off. These things are impossible.
Mm-hmm. There's always the knowledge.
That's just
problem.
What I was thinking.
All right. John, do you have any final notes before we get into summary and review?
Well, there's a few, like a couple things. I don't know if everybody's aware, but Arlie Ermey was, who's the drill sergeant in the first half of the film. He was originally on the film as a technical director. He was, you know, had military experience. He was, but when he put together like kind of an instructional video and Kubrick looked at it, he said, he's got to be the drill sergeant. Like, this is the perfect guy. Like, nobody else can do this. He's the guy. So that, I thought that was a little bit, it's a trivia, but looking at the film in today's perspective, if you showed this to, like, if you went down to Portland and you showed this film on a big screen, I think what you would see is the prostitute scenes would be very patriarchal. And I think, like, you know, the cavalier attitude towards race, like the eight ball. Well, first of all, the scene with the prostitute where animal mother says all fucking N-words must fucking hang. And when eight ball says put an N-word behind the trigger, I think that would be very problematic in today's culture. And I feel triggered just thinking about it right now. I just want to, like, you know, screech at the top of my lungs autistically.
You should probably smash a Starbucks, man.
I should set fire to something.
That'll show them.
Yeah, that'll end patriarchy and racism.
But yeah, there are a lot of those themes in this, and I can imagine that there'd be an underrepresentation of women, of course, as well. Mm-hmm. At least in the first half of the film.
Yeah, it's like we wouldn't like Private Benjamin had already come out by then. So why the hell didn't we have a strong female character in this? And like G.I. Jane didn't come out for a few years, but I mean, my God.
Yeah. Maybe they should do a Full Metal Jacket too, with like all women cast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Like Ghostbusters.
Like the Ghostbusters. Yeah. That was such a big success. I can't imagine Full Metal Jacket, all women cast would.
It's a winning formula.
Winning formula.
All right, so there's another piece of trivia related to the drill sergeant role, and that was the original intention was to have the guy who did the male rape scene in Deliverance.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I was telling this to you, John, and I am. And Kubrick even had talked to him on the phone, and the guy was about to fly out to England, and then Kubrick backed out because he was just too terrified of the guy based on his scenes in Deliverance. And that was even after talking to the director of Deliverance and finding out what kind of person the actor was. He's like, oh yeah, he's easy to work with. He's a good guy. But Kubrick just couldn't get over the depiction of what he called the scariest scene put to film.
He was fooled by his performance. That's a great compliment, actually.
Yeah, I think so. So I have an idea that we could tie our themes of movies we do with you, John, not only with Matthew Modine, but also perhaps with the Harley Emery character, Drill Sergeant, and do Deliverance at some time in the future.
Excellent. Well, as you know, like, I'm a big fan of hillbilly rape, so.
Who isn't?
So that'll be a future episode to look forward to, everyone. Well, Robert, why don't you throw us into final summary and review, and we'll start to wind down the show here.
Sure. Well, I can talk about this film some more. I think if you like war films, I think you're going to like this. It's you know, war films, like I said, they generally trap the character into doing what they're told. So you don't have this strong narrative. You don't have a strong protagonist making decisions and that sort of thing. But in this film, you don't even get a whole lot of, I mean, you do get some change from the wide-eyed, you know, baby boys just entering boot camp to the grizzled veterans at the end. But I don't know, that's not necessarily a unique thing for a war movie. Although this movie does definitely focus on the boot camp for far longer than the average war film. The performances are all great. Kubrick's directing is fantastic, but I don't know the novel that it was based on. I never read it, so I don't know how authentic it is or how much they, you know, deviate or anything like that, or what exactly even the theme is of the novel. I didn't like it as much as my co-hosts, but I'm not to say that this is a bad film. I just didn't connect with the main character in a way that I generally like to connect with them. I like to have my characters make decisions that I would do, or that at least I could respect or surprise me. But in this film, he doesn't do any of them. And it's definitely, Joker is definitely the main character, but I don't even know if this is Joker's story. It's, like I said, it's just the story of Joker's view of Vietnam, which is, I think, a less interesting thing. It's not a human story in so much. It's more of a documentary film. Take it for what it will. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just not what I would have wanted, I guess, in wanting to see a dramatic film about a war. But maybe, you know, it's obviously stood the test of time. It is unique in war films. I don't think there's anything else quite like it, but I can't give this much more than it's a funny way to rate it, but I have to say that this movie is at least a 7, but it's not something that I would watch 74 times. It's something that I watch 12 times, maybe if I've had a few, but it's like a 7, but I wouldn't recommend it to everybody.
All right. Well, that's kind of a nuanced grade.
It's like the duality of man, Daniel. You know how it's like well-made movie, but I don't recommend it. It's like the duality of man.
Yeah, it's Jungian shit. Yeah. Well, I'm going to kind of echo a little bit off of what you're saying here. I think that Kubrick does have a technical brilliance about him. And I think that he isn't going for the traditional story. Many, you know, war films have been made. The traditional storylines and plot lines have been done many times in the past. And so to do something a little bit different, I think, was somewhat purposeful. And I think he still did a great job. I kind of like this theory I'm developing in my head about that the duality of man really is a significant meaning to describe the entire film. And the Joker and Pyle were kind of the same character initially, and then we show the breakdown of the individual and some parts splinter off, and you create this new socialist kind of man willing to kill. And Kubrick also did a lot of like symbolism and meaning within how we presented the shots. Like during that kill chant that the recruits were saying, he zooms in on Pyle's face as they're saying that. It's like saying that this guy has lost connection. And now he's going to kill. It's like this kind of premonition kind of thing that you see him do a lot in The Shining. And again, I think that because he could turn war-torn Vietnam out of pastoral England countryside, I think he definitely did do the moon landing. And overall, I think it's a really good film. I think it actually ages well, and it gets better as you watch it and as you kind of ponder on it and then watch it again. And I definitely love Arlie Emery's lines. Every one of them is hilarious. And I know that a lot of it was him kind of off the cuff, kind of ad-libbing. They'd record that and then write that into the film. And so he had, I don't know if he got a writer's credit for it, but I think most of the lines were written by him in a sort of spontaneous manner, recorded and then transcribed. And then they would pick the choicest lines. And I think it turned out to be spectacular. So I love this movie. I think it's a 9 for me. And I will go to John.
Well, unlike Robert, I think I could watch it 74 times, and I probably have. This is one of my, like I said before, I saw Platoon first, and then I saw this, and I thought this is a much better film than Platoon. And I love Platoon, but to Robert's point, Platoon is a more structured story. It's more character development. Now, when I was in film school, I was subjected to films by all these really avant-garde directors like Fellini, Godard, Bergman. So I understand like the notion of, you know, seeing things that aren't traditionally structured or characters that aren't traditionally developed and kind of being off put by that. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I think this is a time where it really does work. I think even though you don't know Joker's past per se, you don't get the development of him up until he hits boot camp. I think you kind of know who he is, and I think you understand his role in the Marines and what he's doing there and all throughout the film. Now, yes, he's not like pretty much a protagonist kind of character, but it works for me. I love the film, and I couldn't recommend it anymore. I give it like I give it a 9.5 out of 10.
All right. Yeah. High praise from two of us, and not so shabby from Robert, who generally hates films despite being a movie review guy on a show. Last Nighters here. Episode 137. Show notes and more. LastNighters.com/137. Also, if you like what we do here, check us out at the old Patreon where you can get extra bonus content. We do a thing after the show called Kathleen Turner Overdrive, which is special bonus content. Also, people can view us watching or creating this sausage live during the live stream. We have a special group on Facebook where people can watch this. We also send out links via Patreon, and a couple of people get it individually via instant messenger from me. So very high class, high level service provided by us here at the show. Robert, are there other things that people can do to support the work we do here?
Yeah, there are, Daniel. I'm glad you asked me, because there are ways you can support the show. Beyond just thinking about the show, thinking about the points you've raised, and then deciding that we're wrong, and then writing me angry emails about why I'm wrong, which I actually really, really enjoy. So please feel free to do that. But you can subscribe to the YouTube channel. You can leave a comment. You can leave a like. You could subscribe, like I just said. You could talk about the show. You can talk to us on Facebook. You could buy some merch at Trapster.com. You could do any of that and more. Don't let me stifle you with your creative brain. I'm sure there are ways which you can imagine.
All right. Very good. And special news for everyone. We have achieved the high enough level of subscribers to get that custom URL on YouTube. So if you want to be a part of the YouTube subscribers, like Robert has mentioned twice already, you can go to YouTube.com/LastNighters, and you too can hit that bell icon and subscribe and get notifications on when we are posting our shows, which these come out on Monday. You can watch us crank out these movie review shows that we do here. We've been doing for a few years now.
Like, share, subscribe.
Hit that bell icon or whatever they say.
Smash that like button.
Smash it. That's so 2017, Robert. Jeez, I can't believe you
said
they're
still smashing it. I think they're still smashing it.
Point down. Hit subscribe and share. Mm.
It's down right in the description. It's all in the description.
$20. Make it happen.
Beat you $15.
All right, John, any final words on where people can check your stuff out and anything you'd like to punch out there before we get into our bonus content?
JohnRecreative.com. It's my website. If you want to check it out and contact me, if you have anything that you want to collaborate on, copywriting or video oriented content, I'm down for it.
Or guest appearances to talk about movies, which we will do with you again on Deliverance at some point in the near future, a couple of months out, probably.
Excellent.
All right. Well, that's our show, you maggots. So thank you guys very much. Check it out, lastnighters.com/137. Also at the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction, thelaunchpadmedia.com. And we'll see you guys on the next one where oh, I didn't mention it. Jeez, I can't believe this. We're going to have Dr. Dennis Foster back on to do the World War II movie, Conspiracy. So another war movie sort of thing, but this one's from the Nazi perspective on how they figure out what they're going to do. And it's going to be an interesting discussion, I think. And it might be too hot for YouTube. I don't know. We might get demonetized just for saying Nazis a bunch. I don't know. But it should be a good one. And we will be back for that next week. So check it out then. And until then, we'll say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, and we're going to continue the transmission for just a hair longer on the Actual Anarchy podcast, episode 194 of the show on Full Metal Jacket, actualanarchy.com/194. We are the Phony Tough and the Crazy Brave, and as I mentioned, we're going to be doing Conspiracy next week, which, John, you and I had talked about a while back, about you perhaps wanting to do that one. So in lieu of you being on for that episode, do you have like a short take that we can lead into next episode?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give too much away or take away too much from the episode you're going to do about it. But I thought, I mean, just from a film standpoint, it's really, the dialogue is awesome. And I think it's very well shot. It's like in pretty much in one single room the whole time. And I think it's really indicative of kind of like the ultimate power in government. You have all these people around this table who are there to give their own input about what to do about the Jewish question. But ultimately, it's just all up to one person. And that's ultimately what everybody there learns, and they better fall in line or there's going to be trouble for them. But I think it sounds like a boring film when you hear about it, but I think if you watch it, it's really compelling, and I can watch it over and over again. It's another one of my favorite films.
Okay, I almost feel bad that we're not going to have you on it, but Dennis has been a great guest in the past, and I'm sure that he'll be awesome on it. And just, you know, now that you mention your take on it, I watched that, and then I watched Death of Stalin, and it also kind of has a similar feel or vibe to it, and there's a lot of being in one space or one room, like that mansion kind of space, and I wonder if I'm sort of thinking about them almost mixed almost together right now. So I'm going to definitely need to watch Conspiracy again before we do that episode. Otherwise I might start mentioning some Stalin, Death of Stalin stuff.
Not as much humor in Conspiracy.
Almost zero.
Almost zero.
Well, you don't know my humor. Eh? Anyway, so thank you for your take. Robert, any final points or comments you want to make or bring us back to Full Metal Jacket for a moment before we get into Kathleen Turner Overdrive?
Yeah, is $15 too much to pay for gonorrhea?
I think it's a bargain.
I do have a meme that says $20 make you holler, and then Joker says, I heard you have coronavirus. And she says, fine, make it 10. So I can post that on the show's page. That might get us kicked off. I don't know. We'll see.
Okay.
It's good. It's funny. It's funny. All right, well, that's been our show tonight, everyone. So check it out, actualanarchy.com/194. And we will be back with you guys next week for Conspiracy. And until then, maximum freedom, everyone. Peace out.
the chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.